It seems like every year or so, or perhaps even more frequently, we welcome local author Ridley Pearson to the program to talk about a new book. Well, here we go again. He is up to 50-plus, as I understand it, with publication of his latest and apparently the last in the Return series titled Disney at Last. It's part of his successful Kingdom Keepers series for young readers. That series, just another indication of Ridley's range and subject matter and genres. Ridley Pearson, welcome once again.
Thanks for having me. What a pleasure.
You know, I'm always stunned and astonished by how prolific you are. 50-plus books. You're a young man. And you were talking to the ladies as they were leaving about watching television. When do you have time?
Yeah, well, I actually use television to sort of I often just fall asleep in front of the most provocative shows because it clears my head a little.
Yeah, well, television can also confuse these days, can it?
Yeah, really.
You know, last time we talked, it was about your book, White Bone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and which centered basically on a poaching problem
right,
in Africa.
Right, which is still out there, and the problem is beginning to be worked on a little,
well,
which is nice.
That's what I wanted to bring up and just get your reaction to it. I saw the other day that China, apparently, is cracking down on ivory sales and transactions in that country, which would have a tremendous impact on the elephant population to begin with.
Now that the price is dropping.
Yeah, well, that does often have an influence on it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it isn't. It's probably too little too late, but at least everybody's more aware, I think, of the problem in terms of nationally. The U.S. has done more. China's doing more. Kenya had what's called a burn. They had a huge burn about a year ago. And I think, all of those things bring world attention to it. It's a little bit like global warming, I think, and is it too little too late?
Yeah.
When I first was researching and looking into writing White Bone, there was a nine-year amount of elephants left in the wild. Mm. That was, 3 years ago? So I would imagine that's down to about 6 years now. Mm-hmm. And whether or not, you can turn the reproduction rate around and start reestablishing the herds, I don't know. At that point, we were losing an elephant an hour.
Oh, wow.
Internationally. And I really don't know the numbers, but it was a terrifying thing then. And, it certainly isn't over, but I'm sure glad that the Chinese government is cracking down on it more. But it's interesting that they made that decision as the oversupply pulled prices down.
Well, the oversupply being the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you were really impacted by that.
It
was clearly the last time we talked, and it's clear now.
Yeah. And my our daughter Story is heading over to Mozambique to the Gorongosa State Park. A friend of ours, Greg Carr, has taken a 99-year lease on 600,000 acres of the Gorongosa Park and is working to find a way to integrate battling poverty and conserving at the same time. Those have really been the two issues that haven't worked well in Africa. If you conserve a piece of land, then you're keeping the farmers off it. They get resentful. You're keeping the hunters off it. They get resentful. They claim it, and probably rightly so, that it impacts poverty because there's less arable land. If you don't do that, you lose the herds and you lose the rhinos, the elephants, the jaguar, everything. So how do you manage that? And Greg and his team have been researching this and working on it now for a number of years. And our daughter's Story is going over there for her senior project at the Principia to sort of study this. And I think one of the really fascinating sides of that is that Greg's group knows that the only way to make this work is to work with the 20 communities that surround Gorongosa. Mm-hmm. And so they've worked a lot with the schools, a lot with the farmer groups. And one of the things Story is going to research and follow is they have a group there called the Girls Club. And the young women in these communities are often sold as too derisive a term, but arranged marriages. Hmm. occur at the age of 13 for most of these young women, 12 and 13. And they stop their education then because by 14 they're pregnant for the first time and by 16 they're pregnant for the second time. By 17 they're a mom with two kids. Sure. And this girls' club has been led by a mother and a daughter who was one of these potential young women who through Greg's work took more education and is now actually going to attend her first year at Boise State College in the fall. And she's going to lead story around to these communities where they have the program, the Girls Club, which tries to explain to these young women that if they resist somewhat with their parents this idea of being getting a dowry and being sort of sold off at 13 and getting an education, there's a bigger world out there.
Right. It's a different circumstance than the characters in your Kingdom Keepers series.
And quite. And, two different worlds.
And the readers of that series,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, exactly. Who are also 13, but who have full educations and are for the most part, highly educated kids.
So, yeah. How do you, as an author with a few years on you at this point, get into the mind and head of a 13-year-old and 14-year-old?
Well, for a decade, I wrote books with an American treasure named Dave Barry.
Oh, yeah.
And
Here.
And whenever that was asked of Dave, he would say, "Are you kidding me? Ridley and I never got past 13." So, I mean, I think there's a part of me that is forever adolescent. And so it isn't difficult, but I have kids and I watch the struggles they go through and I watch where they make good and bad decisions. And the youngest is now 18. So I've had a good 5, 6, 7, 8 years of 9 years maybe of watching teenagers in our house be complete idiots and savants, both ends of the spectrum. And all I really have to do is sort of, you know, sit on the couch and watch for my material.
You don't have to leave the house to do your research.
No, that's right. I also have volunteered at local schools and spoken to schools around the country. And so I'm in contact and rub elbows with middle schoolers day in and day out. And it's amazing because I had 6 students from the Principia read the first Lock and Key novel. That's a series that deals with the origins of James Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. And I was just going to give them one chapter. And their observations were so spot on. And they're really their edit without them knowing it, their edits of this book were so spot on. I was in the process of writing it that I ended up sharing the whole novel with them. And they crafted in so many ways. And again, they weren't really aware they were doing this, but they shaped and crafted this novels in ways where I would have made big mistakes because I was unaware of what was important and not important.
And that could be easy to do, and thereby you lose the reader. If they don't make that connection, if you don't have that
connection.
Oh, my
gosh, in an instant. Yeah. In a nanosecond. The heart, you know, people ask, how do you write for adults and for younger readers?
Right.
And I said, well, surprisingly, writing for adults is somewhat easier because they read the book once and refer it to a friend. My younger readers read these books 6, 7, and 8 times each book, and they catch every little mistake in them. And they are not shy about sharing those with me.
And they also go through, during that age period, they're going through different phases of their lives.
Yeah,
so it could be
true.
A 13-year-old and a 14-year-old might see that written page totally differently.
Yeah, that's very true. I hadn't even thought of that. And they, you know, as younger readers, I try to share, you know, what is certainly a limited amount of wisdom in those pages without preaching. Yeah. I will occasionally have one character say, you know, well, it's better to listen than to gab all the time. Yeah. And what fascinates me is those are, in fact, the pieces that the readers remember. And at these school things, they come up and say, you know, a page that changed my life in these books. I go, changed your life, you know. But you really do have, without knowing it, you have that impact on young readers. It's quite astonishing. Really.
One of the things I caught in this latest book in the Return series was in a very subtle way you had to remind readers that back in 1950, they have a time travel thing, going back to 1955, is that there were no cell phones.
Yeah.
The technology that kids are used to today and would have used in certain circumstances had it been available. You have to say, well, it wasn't there then.
Yeah, and thankfully, if a person is reading this book, they aren't on their cell phone. Hmm. And I think one of the great things, you know, from J.K. Rowling on, that fiction does for kids now is it gives them a break from the technology. Yeah. And then to write a series about that break from technology, where they, you know, they reach into their back pocket and go, oh, yeah, this thing won't work here. Mm-hmm. It's like taking your cell phone on a cruise ship or something, you know, 10 miles offshore. You go, oh, end of that.
Are kids reading these days?
Yes. Are they reading? I mean, I think the numbers in middle grade books are up over all of the industry, which is so encouraging.
And surprising.
And surprising. One of the stats that is shocking me right now is that there was a big push into what are called e-books, where you read them online or on a device or even on your phone. Mm-hmm. And those numbers are quickly falling, and hardcover and softcover sales are gaining, especially in middle grade and YA. So the interesting thing to me is kids who are reading a lot on their phones are starting to say, you know what? I like books better. Mom, go buy me the book. Dad, I want books for my birthday.
That is most encouraging, because I think most of us adults think of kids just speaking in terms of a shorthand, communicating in shorthand, 140-character tweets direct messaging, what have you.
Yeah, which is one reason why the seventh book of the Kingdom Keepers series was aimed to get young people writing, not just reading. And so I sort of worked like Arthur Conan Doyle or some other, you know, mid-19th century author for 28 weeks. I wrote a different chapter of book 7 every week, and my readers had a 5-point multiple choice they could pick from that said what direction that should go. And I asked them to write descriptions for me, and we ended up having 150,000 kids participate in that over those 28 weeks.
You mentioned Arthur Conan Doyle, and you mentioned Moriarty a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, one of my all-time favorites.
And that's for young people. What made you decide to bring the two together, the young audience and this classic
character?
It was
actually suggested to me by HarperCollins. Uh-huh. They had really enjoyed Peter and the Starcatchers and the Kingdom Keepers, and which are published by Disney. And they wrote and said, would you ever consider working – no one's ever really told the story of a young James Moriarty. Mm-hmm. And that – because they didn't know, but I was a huge fan of the short stories that involved Sherlock Holmes and really teethed on that. And that was partly why I went into crime writing. But the idea of – you know, people had done young Sherlock Holmes, but not young James Moriarty. And we as writers so often work on the hero arc, where you take Molly and Peter and the Starcatchers, and she starts one way and ends up quite a hero by the end of those novels. And it intrigued me to write the reverse of that, a fairly normal, maybe affluent kid who becomes the world's greatest criminal mastermind. How does that happen?
Yeah. Well, you've done it again. You're working on another one right now.
I understand it. I'm working on the third, and the second of the Lock and Key series comes out in September. And I'm working on a new series of the Kingdom Keepers. This ends the Kingdom Keepers as we know them. But Walt Disney was such an amazing everything. But certainly he had an incredible imagination, and he believed in dreaming. And he wrote an amazing piece that my editor shared with me. In 1956, he was asked to write what the future would look like in 50 years. Mm. And it's an eloquent, beautifully written piece that's about a page long of almost a time capsule of what he thinks the world would be like in 2006. Uh-huh. And in there, in a weird way, is the Kingdom Keepers. And he had envisioned Epcot, which is a park within Disney World, as a future prototype of a future community. And it never really got there. And I thought it would be interesting to pay an homage to that and write a trilogy about what Epcot could have been if I just make it real. Mm-hmm. And so the Kingdom Keepers do find their way into this third series, but they're 40 years old when they find it. And it's really about the children of the Kingdom Keepers living in this state-of-the-art prototype.
But you are bringing that all to an end, or is it just the return series?
In the return series, I bring the Kingdom Keepers at the age we know them to an end. Okay. So it's sort of a 10-book massive series, and now there will be this trilogy that follows it that still has them in it as active players, but it's really more about their children.
You know, I'm not quite sure I understand how you can do this. I mean, thinking ahead, you're talking about Moriarty, you're talking about the Kingdom Keepers and the evolution of all of that. How far ahead do you think and plan for what you're going to be writing?
Well, when you're asked about a series, I really think it's incumbent on the author to know, you know, when before you write a book, you whether you outline or not, you should know, you should have some faint idea of the beginning, middle, and end. I'm a type A outliner, so I know it all. But I don't want to commit to a 3-book deal for Disney or Harper unless I know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. So I sit down and figure it out. I don't figure it out in giant detail. And then I do in detail figure out book one, and I get a real good idea of book two, and I get a real good idea of book three. But I will write book one before I get into the actual crazy detail that I do in outlining.
Ever deviate from the original outline?
Sure, you do. Yeah, yeah. I years ago, I went backpacking on, is it Victoria Island? No, Victoria is the city. What's the big island off of Seattle?
I know because I've read your books.
So anyway, on this island, there was a thing called the West Coast Trail. Uh-huh. And it was installed because of all the shipwrecks in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And they strung a wire, like airline wire cable, for miles and miles and miles. And I took that hike before. It's become a little more populated now and beaten down. But when I took it, it was just rainforest. Mm-hmm. And you followed this cable, literally. I mean, you kept that in sight because that was the only way you knew you were going to finally get to the end of this thing. That's an outline to me is, you know, you keep the outline there so that when you look around and go, where the heck am I? Uh-huh. You can beat your way through the bushes and go, oh, and grab onto that lifeline and find your way to some end. Yeah. But you often wander away from it. And I often wander so far that I'll write 4 or 5 different endings to the book with my editors before we get one that we like.
And now you're getting involved once again with theater.
Yes. I have had the most Jack Lane, who runs Stages St. Louis, had asked me to write a mystery play. And I'm doing it on spec. I mean, it's completely for free. Jack has turned into a fairly big producer on Broadway now. He's got 4 or 5 shows at once on there. And I am having the most fun I think I've had. I've taken years to do this. I can only attack it every now and then. And it may be a piece of junk, but I'm having so much fun with it. Yeah. So I'm writing a play set on a cruise ship that is kind of an old Agatha Christie type mystery.
Are you taking cruises to do your research
there? Well, I am. Yeah. I do that for Disney. In fact, I'm leaving in a couple of weeks. I'm a speaker on the next Disney cruise ship that goes through the Panama Canal. So I give about 6 one-hour talks, and then I do 2 hours of writer's workshops.
Now, that is a pretty good gig.
It's a pretty good gig. It's actually quite tiring. I mean, it's 14 days, and 7 of those days I am just so busy. I mean, I go to bed at like 8:30 at night. But the other days I write, and I get a tremendous amount of writing done there. Right.
By the way, a note from our producer, Kelly Moffitt, Vancouver Island, Bainbridge.
Vancouver!
Vancouver
Thank
Island.
You. Vancouver
so
Island.
We
yep.
got there. In one of our last conversations, we talk about doing research on your sofa and watching the kids or taking a cruise. I was quite taken by the fact that your setting was Istanbul, and you had very detailed descriptions of Istanbul, but you never went there.
No, I couldn't get there. I tried twice to get there and for security reasons didn't end up going, which was probably stupid, but I didn't get there. And God bless the internet, because it turns out with Google Street Maps and all of that, you can go right down onto the street and look at a doorway. And it just – the trouble is it takes forever compared to walking down a street. So in Whitebone, I spent almost a month, three weeks plus in Kenya doing all that sort of site research because it's just easier. I mean, you take pictures, you take notes, you smell it, you taste it, you feel it.
Sure.
With Google, you know, you have to go down and you look at a street and then you look up some tourist's impression of that. It takes forever, but then, you can do it.
And then you got to buy something because they're trying to say, trying
exactly.
to sell you something. Let me point out, Ridley, as our time comes to a close here, that you'll be appearing, as you well know, at the St. Louis County Library headquarters tomorrow.
Tomorrow, right? April 5th.
Yep. At 7 o'clock to discuss and sign Disney at Last. I'm sure the folks who attend will have a lot of fun, as we always do, when we welcome Ridley Pearson. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Continued success. We'll look for the next one.
Thanks.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.